Chapter 26. That the man who wrote it was of the opinion that it was wrong to steal, and that I had not acted right in doing so. I wish now, however, to make an honest statement, which is that I do not believe, in all my checkered career, I stole a ton of peaches. One night I removed a watermelon from a wagon, while the owner was attending to another customer. I crawled off to a secluded spot, where I found that it was green. It was the greenest melon in the Mississippi Valley. Then I began to reflect. I began to be sorry. I wondered what George Washington would have done, had he been in my place. I thought a long time, and then suddenly felt that strange feeling which comes to a man with a good resolution, and I took up that watermelon, and took it back to its owner. I handed him the watermelon, and told him to reform. He took my lecture much to heart, and, when he gave me a good one in place of the green melon, I forgave him. I told him that I would still be a customer of his, and that I cherished no ill feeling because of the incident that would remain green in my memory. Business, the alumni of Eastman College, gave their annual banquet, March 30, 1901, at the YM 100A building. Mr. James G. Cannon, of the 4th National Bank, made the first speech of the evening, after which Mr. Clemens was introduced by Mr. Bailey as the personal friend of Tom Sawyer, who was one of the types of successful businessmen. Mr. Cannon has furnished me with texts enough to last as slow a speaker as myself all the rest of the night. I took exception to the introducing of Mr. Cannon as a great financier, as if he were the only great financier present. I am a financier, but my methods are not the same as Mr. Cannon's. I cannot say that I have turned out the great businessman that I thought I was when I began life. But I am comparatively young yet, and may learn. I am rather inclined to believe that what troubled me was that I got the big head early in the game. I want to explain to you a few points of difference between the principles of business as I see them, and those that Mr. Cannon believes in. He says that the primary rule of business success is loyalty to your employer. That's all right as a theory. What is the matter with loyalty to yourself? As nearly as I can understand Mr. Cannon's methods, there is one great drawback to them. He wants you to work a great deal. Diligence is a good thing, but taking things easy is much more restful. My idea is that the employer should be the busy man, and the employee the idle one. The employer should be the worried man, and the employee the happy one. And why not? He gets the salary. My plan is to get another man to do the work for me. And that there's more repose. What I want is repose first, last, and all the time. Mr. Cannon says that there are three cardinal rules of business success. They are diligence, honesty, and truthfulness. Well, diligence is all right. Let it go as a theory. Honesty is the best policy when there is money in it. But truthfulness is one of the most dangerous. Why, this man is misleading you. I had an experience today with my wife which illustrates this. I was acknowledging a belated invitation to another dinner for this evening, which seemed to have been sent about 10 days ago. It only reached me this morning. I was mortified at the discourtesy into which I had been brought by this delay, and wondered what was being thought of me by my hosts. As I had accepted your invitation, of course I had to send regrets to my other friends. When I started to write this note, my wife came up and stood looking over my shoulder. Women always want to know what is going on. Said she should, not that read in the third person. I conceded that it should, put aside what I was writing, and commenced over again. That seemed to satisfy her, and so she sat down and let me proceed. I then finished my first note and so sent what I intended. I never could have done this if I had let my wife know the truth about it. Here is what I wrote. To the Ohio Society, I have at this moment received a most kind invitation, 11 days old, from Mr. Southard, President, and the like one, 10 days old, from Mr. Bryant, President of the Press Club. I thank the society cordially for the compliment of these invitations, although I am booked elsewhere and cannot come. But, oh, I should like to know the name of the Lightning Express by which they were forwarded. For I owe a friend a dozen chickens, and I believe it will be cheaper to send eggs instead, and let them develop on the road. Sincerely yours, Mark Twain. I want to tell you of some of my experiences in business, and then I will be in a position to lay down one general rule for the guidance of those who want to succeed in business. My first effort was about 25 years ago. I took hold of an invention. I don't know now what it was all about, but someone came to me and told me it was a good thing, and that there was lots of money in it. He persuaded me to invest $15,000, and I lived up to my beliefs by engaging a man to develop it. To make a long story short, I sunk $40,000 in it. Then I took up the publication of a book. I called in a publisher and said to him, I want you to publish this book along lines which I shall lay down. I am the employer, and you are the employee. I am going to show them some new kinks in the publishing business. And I want you to draw on me for money as you go along, which he did. He drew on me for $56,000. Then I asked him to take the book and call it off. But he refused to do that. My next venture was with a machine for doing something or other. I knew less about that than I did about the invention. But I sunk $170,000 in the business, and I can't for the life of me recollect what it was the machine was to do. I was still undismayed. You see, one of the strong points about my business life was that I never gave up. I undertook to publish General Grant's book, and made $140,000 in 6 months. My axiom is, to succeed in business, avoid my example. Carnegie the Benefactor, at the dinner given in honor of Andrew Carnegie by the Lotos Club, March 17, 1909, Mr. Clemens appeared in a white suit from head to feet. He wore a white double-breasted coat, white trousers, and white shoes. The only relief was a big black cigar, which he confidentially informed the company was not from his usual stack bought at $3 per barrel. The state of Missouri has for its coat of arms a barrel head with two Missourians, one on each side of it, and mark the motto, "Knighted we stand, divided we fall." Mr. Carnegie, this evening, has suffered from compliments. It is interesting to hear what people will say about a man. Why, at the banquet given by this club in my honor, Mr. Carnegie had the inspiration for which the club is now honoring him. If Dunfermline contributed so much to the United States in contributing Mr. Carnegie, what would have happened if all Scotland had turned out? These Dunfermline folk have acquired advantages in coming to America. Dr. McKelway paid the top compliment, the cumulation, when he said of Mr. Carnegie, "There is a man who wants to pay more taxes than he is charged." Richard Watson Gilder did very well for a poet. He advertised his magazine. He spoke of hiring Mr. Carnegie. The next thing he will be trying to hire me. If I undertook to pay compliments, I would do it stronger than any others have done it, for what Mr. Carnegie wants are strong compliments. Now, the other side of 70, I have preserved, as my chiefest virtue, modesty. On poetry, veracity, and suicide, address at a dinner of the Manhattan Dickens Fellowship, New York City, February 7, 1906. This dinner was in commemoration of the 94th anniversary of the birth of Charles Dickens. On another occasion, Mr. Clemens told the same story with variations, and a different conclusion to the University Settlement Society. I always had taken an interest in young people who wanted to become poets. I remember I was particularly interested in one budding poet when I was a reporter. His name was Butter. One day he came to me and said, disconsolately, that he was going to commit suicide. He was tired of life, not being able to express his thoughts in poetic form. Butter asked me what I thought of the idea. I said I would, that it was a good idea. Who can do me a friendly turn? You go off in a private place, and do it there, and I'll get it all. You do it, and I'll do as much for you sometime. At first he determined to drown himself. Drowning is so nice and clean, and writes up so well in a newspaper. But things never do go smoothly in weddings, suicides, or courtships. Only there at the edge of the water, where Butter was to end himself, lay a life preserver, a big round canvas one, which would float after the scrap iron was soaked out of it. Butter wouldn't kill himself with the life preserver in sight, and so I had an idea. I took it to a pawn shop, and soaked it for a revolver. The pawnbroker didn't think much of the exchange, but when I explained the situation he acquiesced. We went up on top of a high building, and this is what happened to the poet. He put the revolver to his forehead, and blew a tunnel straight through his head. The tunnel was about the size of your finger. You could look right through it. The job was complete. There was nothing in it. Well, after that man never could write prose, but he could write poetry. He could write it, after he had blown his brains out. There is lots of that talent all over the country, but the trouble is they don't develop it. I am suffering now from the fact that I, who have told the truth a good many times in my life, have lately received more letters than anybody else urging me to lead a righteous life. I have more friends who want to see me develop on a high level than anybody else. Young John D. Rockefeller, 2 weeks ago, taught his Bible class all about veracity, and why it was better that everybody should always keep a plentiful supply on hand. Some of the letters I have received suggest that I ought to attend his class and learn to. Why, I know Mr. Rockefeller, and he is a good fellow. He is competent in many ways to teach a Bible class, but when it comes to veracity he is only 35 years old. I'm 70 years old. I have been familiar with veracity twice, as long as he. And the story about George Washington and his little hatchet has also been suggested to me in these letters in a fugitive way, as if I needed some of George Washington and his hatchet in my constitution. Why, dear me, they overlook the real point in that story. The point is not the one that is usually suggested, and you can readily see that. The point is not that George said to his father, "Yes, father, I cut down the cherry tree. I can't tell a lie," but that the little boy only 7 years old should have his sagacity developed under such circumstances. He was a boy wise beyond his years. His conduct then was a prophecy of later years. Yes, I think he was the most remarkable man the country ever produced up to my time, anyway. Now then, little George realized that circumstantial evidence was against him. He knew that his father would know from the size of the chips that no full-grown hatchet cut that tree down, and that no man would have haggled it so. He knew that his father would send around the plantation and inquire for a small boy with a hatchet, and he had the wisdom to come out and confess it. Now, the idea that his father was overjoyed when he told little George that he would rather have him cut down 1,000 cherry trees than tell a lie is all nonsense. What did he really mean? Why, that he was absolutely astonished that he had a son who had the chance to tell a lie and didn't. I admire old George, if that was his name, for his discernment. He knew when he said that his son couldn't tell a lie that he was stretching it a good deal. He wouldn't have to go to John D. Rockefeller's Bible class to find that out. The way the old George Washington story goes down, it doesn't do anybody any good. It only discourages people who can tell a lie. Welcome home, address at the dinner in his honor at the Lotos Club, November 10, 1900, in August, 1895, just before sailing for Australia, Mr. Clemens issued the following statement. It has been reported that I sacrificed, for the benefit of the creditors, the property of the publishing firm whose financial backer I was, and that I am now lecturing for my own benefit. This is an error. I intend the lectures, as well as the property, for the creditors. The law recognizes no mortgage on a man's brains, and a merchant who has given up all he has may take advantage of the laws of insolvency and may start free again for himself. But I am not a businessman, and honor is a harder master than the law. It cannot compromise for less than 100 cents on a dollar, and its debts are never outlawed. I had a 2/3 interest in the publishing firm whose capital I furnished. If the firm had prospered, I would have expected to collect 2/3 of the profits. As it is, I expect to pay all the debts. My partner has no resources, and I do not look for assistance to my wife, whose contributions in cash from her own means have nearly equaled the claims of all the creditors combined. S.E. has taken nothing. On the contrary, S.E. has helped and intends to help me to satisfy the obligations due to the rest of the creditors. It is my intention to ask my creditors to accept that as a legal discharge, and trust to my honor to pay the other 50% as fast as I can earn it. From my reception thus far on my lecturing tour, I am confident that if I live I can pay off the last debt within 4 years. After which, at the age of 64, I can make a fresh and unencumbered start in life. I am going to Australia, India, and South Africa, and next year I hope to make a tour of the great cities of the United States. I thank you all out of my heart for this fraternal welcome, and it seems almost too fine, almost too magnificent, for a humble Missourian such as I am, far from his native haunts on the banks of the Mississippi. Yet my modesty is in a degree fortified by observing that I am not the only. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.